Evangelical Teaching. George Eliot. Another student of Hegel and Feuerbach and the other German idealists was Mary Ann Evans, 1819 to 1890, who wrote imperishable novels under the nom de plume of George Eliot. She translated David Friedrich Strauss's book, Das Leben Jesu, with its subversive claim that the purported events of the New Testament were mythical. In defiance of Victorian morality, she set up her home with the married freethinker George Henry Lewes. George Eliot was one of the editors of the Westminster Review, and in 1855 published an attack on a then well-known evangelical divine. I shall be surprised if this essay does not remind you of some more recent religious performers. Given a man with moderate intellect, a moral standard not higher than the average, some rhetorical affluence, and great glibness of speech, what is the career in which, without the aid of birth or money, he may most easily attain power and reputation in English society? Where is that Goshen of mediocrity in which a smattering of science and learning will pass for profound instruction, where platitudes will be accepted as wisdom, bigoted narrowness as holy zeal, unctuous egoism as God-given piety? Let such a man become an evangelical preacher. He will then find it possible to reconcile small ability with great ambition, superficial knowledge with the prestige of erudition, a middling morale with a high reputation for sanctity. Let him shun practical extremes and be ultra only in what is purely theoretic. Let him be stringent on predestination, but latitudinarian on fasting, unflinching in insisting on the eternity of punishment, but diffident of curtailing the substantial comforts of time, ardent and imaginative on the pre-millennial advent of Christ, but cold and cautious toward every other infringement of the status quo. Let him fish for souls not with the bait of inconvenient singularity, but with the dragnet of comfortable conformity. Let him be hard and literal in his interpretation only when he wants to hurl texts at the heads of unbelievers and adversaries, but when the letter of the Scriptures presses too closely on the genteel Christianity of the 19th century. Let him use his spiritualizing alembic and disperse it into impalpable ether. Let him preach less of Christ than of Antichrist. Let him be less definite in showing what sin is than in showing who is the man of sin, less expansive on the blessedness of faith than on the accursedness of infidelity. Above all, let him set up as an interpreter of prophecy and rival Moore's almanac in the prediction of political events, tickling the interest of hearers who are but moderately spiritual by showing how the Holy Spirit has dictated problems and charades for their benefit, and how, if they are ingenious enough to solve these, they may have their Christian graces nourished by learning precisely to whom they may point as the horn that had eyes, the lying prophet, and the unclean spirits. In this way he will draw men to him by the strong cords of their passions, made reason-proof by being baptized with the name of piety. In this way he may gain a metropolitan pulpit. The avenues to his church will be as crowded as the passages to the opera. He has but to print his prophetic sermons and bind them in lilac and gold, and they will adorn the drawing-room table of all evangelical ladies who will regard as a sort of pious light reading the demonstration that the prophecy of the locusts, whose sting is in their tail, is fulfilled in the fact of the Turkish commander's having taken a horse's tail for his standard, and that the French are the very frogs predicted in the Revelation. Pleasant to the clerical flesh under such circumstances is the arrival of Sunday. Somewhat at a disadvantage during the week, in the presence of working day interests and lay splendors, on Sunday the preacher becomes the cynosure of a thousand eyes, and predominates at once over the amphitryon with whom he dines, and the most captious member of his church or vestry. He has an immense advantage over all other public speakers. The platform orator is subject to the criticism of hisses and groans. Counsel for the plaintiff expects the retort of counsel for the defendant. The honourable gentleman on one side of the house is liable to have his facts and figures shown up by the honourable friend on the opposite side. Even the scientific or literary lecturer if he is dull or incompetent, may see the best part of his audience slip quietly out one by one. But the preacher is completely master of the situation. No one may hiss, no one may depart. Like the writer of imaginary conversations, he may put what imbecilities he pleases into the mouths of his antagonists, and swell with triumph when he has refuted them. He may riot in gratuitous assertions, confident that no man will contradict him. He may exercise perfect free will in logic, and invent illustrative experience. He may give an evangelical edition of history, with the inconvenient facts omitted. All this he may do with impunity, certain that those of his hearers who are not sympathizing are not listening. For the press has no band of critics who go the round of the churches and chapels, and are on the watch for a slip or defect in the preacher, to make a feature in their article. The clergy are practically the most irresponsible of all talkers. For this reason, at least, it is well that they do not always allow their discourses to be merely fugitive, but are often induced to fix them in that black and white in which they are open to criticism of any man who has the courage and patience to treat them with thorough freedom of speech and pen. It is because we think this criticism of clerical teaching desirable for the public good that we devote some pages to Dr. Cumming. He is, as everyone knows, a preacher of immense popularity, and of the numerous publications in which he perpetuates his pulpit labors, all circulate widely, and some, according to their title page, have reached the 16,000. Now, our opinion of these publications is the very opposite of that given by a newspaper eulogist. We do not believe that the repeated issues of Dr. Cumming's thoughts are having a beneficial effect on society, but the reverse, and hence, little inclined as we are to dwell on his pages, we think it worthwhile to do so, for the sake of pointing out in them what we believe to be profoundly mistaken and pernicious. Of Dr. Cumming, personally, we know absolutely nothing. Our acquaintance with him is confined to a perusal of his works. Our judgment of him is founded solely on the manner in which he has written himself down on his pages. We know neither how he looks nor how he lives. We are ignorant whether, like St. Paul, he has a bodily presence that is weak and contemptible, or whether his person is as florid and as prone to amplification as his style. For aught we know, he may not only have the gift of prophecy, but may bestow the profits of all his works to feed the poor, and be ready to give his own body to be burned with as much alacrity as he infers the everlasting burning of Roman Catholics and Puseyites. Out of the pulpit he may be a model of justice, truthfulness, and the love that thinketh no evil, but we are obliged to judge of his charity by the spirit we find in his sermons, and shall only be glad to learn that his practice is, in many respects, an amiable non sequitur from his teaching. One of the most striking characteristics of Dr. Cummings's writings is unscrupulosity of statement. His motto apparently is Christianitatem, quocunque moda Christianitatem. And the only system he includes under the term Christianity is Calvinistic Protestantism. Experience has so long shown that the human brain is a congenial nidus for inconsistent beliefs, that we do not pause to inquire how Dr. Cumming, who attributes the conversation of the unbelieving to the divine spirit, can think it necessary to cooperate with that spirit by argumentative white lies. Nor do we for a moment impugn the genuineness of his zeal for Christianity, or the sincerity of his conviction that the doctrines he preaches are necessary to salvation. On the contrary, we regard the flagrant unveracity found on his pages as an indirect result of that conviction, as a result, namely, of the intellectual and moral distortion of view which is inevitably produced by assigning to dogmas, based on a very complex structure of evidence, the place and authority of first truths. A distinct appreciation of the value of evidence, in other words, the intellectual perception of truth, is more closely allied to truthfulness of statement, or the moral quality of veracity, than is generally admitted. That highest moral habit, the constant preference of truth, both theoretically and practically, preeminently demands the cooperation of the intellect with the impulses, as is indicated by the fact that it is only found in anything like completeness in the highest class of minds. And it is commonly seen that, in proportion as religious sects believe themselves to be guided by direct inspiration rather than by a spontaneous exertion of their faculties, their sense of truthfulness is misty and confused. No one can have talked to the more enthusiastic Methodists and listened to their stories of miracles without perceiving that they require no other passport to a statement than that it accords with their wishes and their general conception of God's dealings. Nay, they regard as a symptom of sinful skepticism an inquiry into the evidence for a story, which they think unquestionably tends to the glory of God, and in retailing such stories, new particulars, further tending to his glory, are borne in upon their minds. Now, Dr. Cumming, as we have said, is no enthusiastic pietist, within a certain circle, within the mill of evangelical orthodoxy. His intellect is perpetually at work, but that principle of sophistication, which our friends the Methodists derive from the predominance of their pietistic feelings, is involved for him in the doctrine of verbal inspiration. What is for them a state of emotion submerging the intellect is with him a formula imprisoning the intellect, depriving it of its proper function, the free search for truth, and making it the mere servant of all work to a foregone conclusion. Minds fettered by this doctrine no longer inquire concerning a proposition, whether it is attested by sufficient evidence, but whether it accords with Scripture. They do not search for facts, as such, but for facts that will bear out their doctrine. They become accustomed to reject the more direct evidence in favor of the less direct, and where adverse evidence reaches demonstration, they must resort to devices and expedients in order to explain away contradiction. It is easy to see that this mental habit blunts not only the perception of truth, but the sense of truthfulness, and that the man whose faith drives him into fallacies treads close upon the precipice of falsehood. We have entered into this digression for the sake of mitigating the inference that is likely to be drawn from that characteristic of Dr. Cummings's works to which we have pointed. He is much in the same intellectual condition as that professor of Padua, who, in order to disprove Galileo's discovery of Jupiter's satellites, urged that as there were only seven metals, there could not be more than seven planets, a mental condition scarcely compatible with candor. And we may well suppose that if the professor had held the belief in seven planets, and no more, to be a necessary condition of salvation, his mental vision would have been so dazed that even if he had consented to look through Galileo's telescope, his eyes would have reported in accordance with his inward alarms rather than with the external fact. So long as a belief in propositions is regarded as indispensable to salvation, the pursuit of truth, as such, is not possible, any more than it is possible for a man who is swimming for his life to make meteorological observations on the storm which threatens to overwhelm him. The sense of alarm and haste, the anxiety for personal safety, which Dr. Cumming insists upon as the proper religious attitude, unmans the nature and allows no thorough, calm thinking, no truly noble, disinterested feeling. Hence, we by no means suspect that the unscrupulosity of statement with which we charge Dr. Cumming extends beyond the sphere of his theological prejudices. Religion apart, he probably appreciates and practices veracity. In marshalling the evidences of Christianity, Dr. Cumming directs most of his arguments against opinions that are either totally imaginary or that belong to the past rather than to the present, while he entirely fails to meet the difficulties actually felt and urged by those who are unable to accept revelation. There can hardly be a stronger proof of misconception as to the character of free thinking in the present day than the recommendation of Leland's short and easy method with the deists, a method which is unquestionably short and easy for preachers disinclined to consider their stereotyped modes of thinking and arguing, but which has quite ceased to realize those epithets in the conversion of deists. Yet Dr. Cumming not only recommends this book, but also takes the trouble himself to write a feebler version of its arguments. For example, on the question of the genuineness and authenticity of the New Testament writings, he says, "If, therefore, at a period long subsequent to the death of Christ, a number of men had appeared in the world, drawn up a book which they christened by the name of Holy Scripture, and recorded these things which appear in it as facts, when they were only the fancies of their own imagination, surely the Jews would have instantly reclaimed that no such events transpired, that no such person as Jesus Christ appeared in their capital, and that their crucifixion of him, and their alleged evil treatment of his apostles, were mere fictions." It is scarcely necessary to say that, in such argument as this, Dr. Cumming is beating the air. He is meeting a hypothesis which no one holds, and totally missing the real question. The only type of infidel whose existence Dr. Cumming recognizes is that fossil personage who calls the Bible a lie and a forgery. He seems to be ignorant, or he chooses to ignore the fact, that there is a large body of eminently instructed and earnest men who regard the Hebrew and Christian scriptures as a series of historical documents, to be dealt with according to the rules of historical criticism, and that an equally large number of men, who are not historical critics, find the dogmatic scheme built on the letter of the scriptures opposed to their profoundest moral convictions. Dr. Cummings's infidel is a man who, because his life is vicious, tries to convince himself that there is no God, and that Christianity is an imposture, but who is all the while secretly conscious that he is opposing the truth, and cannot help letting out admissions that the Bible is the book of God. We are favored with the following creed of the infidel: "I believe that there is no God, but that matter is God, and God is matter, and that it is no matter whether there is any God or not. I believe also that the world was not made, but that the world made itself, or that it had no beginning, and that it will last forever. I believe that man is a beast, that the soul is the body, and that the body is the soul, and that after death there is neither body nor soul. I believe that there is no religion, that natural religion is the only religion, and all religion unnatural. I believe not in Moses. I believe in the first philosophers. I believe not in the evangelists. I believe in Chubb, Collins, Toland, Tyndall, and Hobbes. I believe in Lord Bolingbroke, and I believe not in St. Paul. I believe not in revelation. I believe in tradition. I believe in the Talmud. I believe in the Quran. I believe not in the Bible. I believe in Socrates. I believe in Confucius. I believe in Mohammed. I believe not in Christ. And lastly, I believe in all unbelief." The intellectual and moral monster whose creed is this complex web of contradictions is, moreover, according to Dr. Cumming, a being who unites much simplicity and imbecility with his satanic hardihood, much tenderness of conscience with his obdurate vice. Here the proof. "I once met with an acute and enlightened infidel, with whom I reasoned day after day, and for hours together. I submitted to him the internal, the external, and the experimental evidences, but made no impression on his scorn and unbelief. At length I entertained a suspicion that there was something morally rather than intellectually wrong, and that the bias was not in the intellect, but in the heart. One day, therefore, I said to him, 'I must now state my conviction, and you may call me uncharitable, but duty compels me. You are living in some known and gross sin.' The man's countenance became pale. He bowed and left me." Here we have the remarkable psychological phenomenon of an acute and enlightened man who, deliberately purposing to indulge in a favorite sin, and regarding the gospel with scorn and unbelief, is nevertheless so much more scrupulous than the majority of Christians that he cannot embrace sin and the gospel simultaneously, who is so alarmed at the gospel in which he does not believe that he cannot be easy without trying to crush it, whose acuteness and enlightenment suggest to him, as a means of crushing the gospel, to argue from day to day with Dr. Cumming, and who is withal so naive that he is taken by surprise when Dr. Cumming, failing in argument, resorts to accusation, and so tender in conscience that, at the mention of his sin, he turns pale and leaves the spot. If there be any human mind in existence capable of holding Dr. Cummings's creed of the infidel, of at the same time believing in tradition and believing in all unbelief, it must be the mind of the infidel just described, for whose existence we have Dr. Cummings's ex officio word as a theologian. And to theologians we may apply what Sancho Panza says of the bachelors of Salamanca, that they never tell lies, except when it suits their purpose. The total absence from Dr. Cummings's theological mind of any demarcation between fact and rhetoric is exhibited in another passage, where he adopts the dramatic form. Ask the peasant on the hills, and I have asked amid the mountains of Braemar and Deeside, how do you know that this book is divine and that the religion you profess is true? You never read Paley? No, I never heard of him. You have never read Butler? No, I have never heard of him. Nor Chalmers? No, I do not know him. You have never read any books on evidence? No, I have read no such books. Then how do you know this book is true? Know it? Tell me that the Dee, the Cluny, and the Garraweald, the streams at my feet, do not run, that the winds do not sigh amid the gorges of these blue hills, that the sun does not kindle the peaks of Loch Nagar. Tell me my heart does not beat, and I will believe you. But do not tell me the Bible is not divine. I have found its truth illuminating my footsteps, its consolation sustaining my heart. May my tongue cleave to my mouth's roof, and my right hand forget its cunning, if I ever deny what is my deepest inner experience, that this blessed book is the book of God. Dr. Cumming is so slippery and lax in his mode of presentation that we find it impossible to gather whether he means to assert that this is what a peasant on the mountain of Braemar did say, or that it is what such a peasant would say. In the one case, the passage may be taken as a measure of his truthfulness, in the other, of his judgment. His own faith, apparently, has not been altogether intuitive, like that of his rhetorical peasant, for he tells us that he has himself experienced what it is to have religious doubts. I was tainted while at the university by this spirit of skepticism. I thought Christianity might not be true. The very possibility of its being true was the thought I felt I must meet and settle. Conscience could give me no peace till I had settled it. I read, and I have read from that day. For 14 or 15 years, till this, and now I am as convinced, upon the clearest evidence, that this book is the book of God, as that I now address you. This experience, however, instead of impressing on him the fact that doubt may be the stamp of a truth-loving mind, that sunt cibis non credidisse honor est, et fide future pignus, seems to have produced precisely the contrary effect. It has not enabled him even to conceive the condition of a mind perplexed in faith, but pure indeed, craving light, yearning for a faith that will harmonize and cherish its highest powers and aspirations, but unable to find that faith in dogmatic Christianity. His own doubts apparently were of a different kind. Nowhere in his pages have we found a humble, candid, sympathetic attempt to meet the difficulties that may be felt by an ingenuous mind. Everywhere he supposes that the doubter is hardened, conceited, consciously shutting his eyes to the light, a fool who is to be answered according to his folly, that is, with ready replies made up of reckless assertions, of apocryphal anecdotes, and, where other resources fail, of vituperative imputations. As to the reading which he has prosecuted for 15 years, either it has left him totally ignorant of the relation which his own religious creed bears to the criticism and philosophy of the 19th century, or he systematically blinks that criticism and that philosophy, and instead of honestly and seriously endeavouring to meet and solve what he knows to be the real difficulties, contents himself with setting up popping jays to shoot at, for the sake of confirming the ignorance and winning the cheap admiration of his evangelical hearers and readers. like the Catholic preacher who, after throwing down his cap and apostrophizing it as Luther, turned to his audience and said, "You see, this heretical fellow has not a word to say for himself." Dr. Cumming, having drawn his ugly portrait of the infidel and put arguments of a convenient quality into his mouth, finds a short and easy method of confounding this croaking frog. In his treatment of infidels, we imagine he is guided by a mental process which may be expressed in the following syllogism. Whatever tends to the glory of God is true. It is for the glory of God that infidels should be as bad as possible. Therefore, whatever tends to show that infidels are as bad as possible is true. All infidels, he tells us, have been men of gross and licentious lives. Is there not some well-known unbeliever, David Hume, for example, of whom even Dr. Cummings's readers may have heard as an exception? No matter. Someone suspected that he was not an exception, and as that suspicion tends to the glory of God, it is one for a Christian to entertain. If we were unable to imagine this kind of self-sophistication, we should be obliged to suppose that, relying on the ignorance of his evangelical disciples, he fed them with direct and conscious falsehoods. Voltaire, he informs them, declares there is no God. He was an antitheist, that is, one who deliberately and avowedly opposed and hated God, who swore in his blasphemy that he would dethrone him, and advocated the very depths of the lowest sensuality. With regard to many statements of a similar kind, equally at variance with truth, in Dr. Cummings's volumes, we presume that he has been misled by hearsay or by the second-hand character of his acquaintance with free-thinking literature. An evangelical preacher is not obliged to be well-read. Here, however, is a case which the extremist supposition of educated ignorance will not reach. Even books of evidences quote from Voltaire the line, "Si Dieu n'existait pas, il faudrait l'inventer." Even persons fed on the mere whey and buttermilk of literature must know that in philosophy Voltaire was nothing if not a theist. Must know that he wrote not against God, but against Jehovah, the God of the Jews, whom he believed to be a false God. Must know that to say Voltaire was an atheist on this ground is as absurd as to say that a Jacobite opposed hereditary monarchy because he declared the Brunswick family had no title to the throne. That Dr. Cummings should repeat the vulgar fables about Voltaire's death is merely what we might expect from the specimens we have seen of his illustrative stories. A man whose accounts of his own experience are apocryphal is not likely to put borrowed narrative to any severe test. The alliance between intellectual and moral perversion is strikingly typified by the way in which he alternates from the unveracious to the absurd, from misrepresentation to contradiction, side by side with the adduction of facts, such as those we have quoted. We find him arguing on one page that the doctrine of the Trinity was too grand to have been conceived by man, and was therefore divine, and on another page that the Incarnation had been preconceived by man, and is therefore to be accepted as divine. But we are less concerned with the fallacy of his ready replies than with their falsity, and even of this we can only afford space for a very few specimens. Here is one. There is 1,000 times more proof that the Gospel of John was written by him than there is that the Anabasis was written by Xenophon, or the Ars Poetica by Horace. If Dr. Cumming had chosen Plato's epistles or Anacreon's poems instead of the Anabasis or the Ars Poetica, he would have reduced the extent of the falsehood and would have furnished a ready reply which would have been equally effective with his Sunday school teachers and their disputants. Hence, we conclude, this prodigality of misstatement, this exuberance of mendacity, is an effervescence of zeal in majorem gloriam Dei. Elsewhere, he tells us that the idea of the author of the Vestiges is that man is the development of a monkey, that the monkey is the embryo man, so that if you keep a baboon long enough, it will develop itself into a man. How well Dr. Cumming has qualified himself to judge of the ideas in that very unphilosophical book, as he pronounces it, may be inferred from the fact that he implies the author of the Vestiges to have originated the nebula hypothesis. In the volume from which the last extract is taken, even the hardihood of assertion is surpassed by the suicidal character of the argument. It is called The Church Before the Flood, and is devoted chiefly to the adjustment of the question between the Bible and geology. Keeping within the limits we have prescribed to ourselves, we do not enter into the matter of this discussion. We merely pause a little over the volume in order to point out Dr. Cummings's mode of treating the question. He first tells us that the Bible has not a single scientific error in it, that its slightest intimations of scientific principles or natural phenomena have in every instance been demonstrated to be exactly and strictly true. And he asks, how is it that Moses, with no greater education than the Hindu or the ancient philosopher, has written his book, touching science at 1,000 points, so accurately that scientific research has discovered no flaws in it? And yet in those investigations which have taken place in more recent centuries, it has not been shown that he has committed one single error, or made one solitary assertion which can be proved by the maturest science, or by the most eagle-eyed philosopher, to be incorrect, scientifically or historically. According to this, the relation of the Bible to science should be one of the strong points of apologists for revelation. The scientific accuracy of Moses should stand at the head of their evidences, and they might urge with some cogency that, since Aristotle, who devoted himself to science and lived many ages after Moses, does little else than err ingeniously, this fact, that the Jewish lawgiver, though touching science at 1,000 points, has written nothing that has not been demonstrated to be exactly and strictly true, is an irrefragable proof of his having derived his knowledge from a supernatural source. How does it happen, then, that Dr. Cumming forsakes this strong position? How is it that we find him, some pages further on, engaged in reconciling Genesis with the discoveries of science, by means of imaginative hypotheses and feats of interpretation? Surely that which has been demonstrated to be exactly and strictly true does not require hypothesis and critical argument, in order to show that it may possibly agree with those very discoveries by means of which its exact and strict truth has been demonstrated. And why should Dr. Cumming suppose, as we shall presently find him supposing, that men of science hesitate to accept the Bible because it appears to contradict their discoveries? By his own statement, that appearance of contradiction does not exist. On the contrary, it has been demonstrated that the Bible precisely agrees with their discoveries. Perhaps, however, in saying of the Bible that its slightest intimations of scientific principles or natural phenomena have in every instance been demonstrated to be exactly and strictly true, Dr. Cumming merely means to imply that theologians have found out a way of explaining the biblical text so that it no longer, in their opinion, appears to be in contradiction with the discoveries of science. One of two things, therefore: either he uses language without the slightest appreciation of its real meaning, or the assertions he makes on one page are directly contradicted by the arguments he urges on another. Dr. Cummings's principles, or should we rather say confused notions, of biblical interpretation, as exhibited in this volume, are particularly significant of his mental caliber. He says, "Men of science, who are full of scientific investigation and enamored of scientific discovery, will hesitate before they accept a book which, they think, contradicts the plainest and the most unequivocal disclosures they have made in the bowels of the earth, or among the stars of the sky." To all these we answer, as we have already indicated, there is not the least dissonance between God's written book and the most mature discoveries of geological science. One thing, however, there may be. There may be a contradiction between the discoveries of geology and our preconceived interpretations of the Bible. But this is not because the Bible is wrong, but because our interpretation is wrong. The italics, in all cases, are our own. Elsewhere, he says, "It seems to me plainly evident that the record of Genesis, when read fairly and not in the light of our prejudices, and mind you, the essence of popery is to read the Bible in the light of our opinions instead of viewing our opinions in the light of the Bible, in its plain and obvious sense, falls in perfectly with the assertion of geologists, On comparing these two passages, we gather that when Dr. Cumming, under stress of geological discovery, assigns to the biblical text a meaning entirely different from that which, on his own showing, was universally ascribed to it for more than 3,000 years, he regards himself as viewing his opinions in the light of the Bible in its plain and obvious sense. Now he is reduced to one of two alternatives. Either he must hold that the plain and obvious meaning lies in the sum of knowledge possessed by each successive age, the Bible being an elastic garment for the growing thought of mankind, or he must hold that some portions are amenable to this criterion, and others not so. In the former case, he accepts the principle of interpretation adopted by the early German rationalists. In the latter case, he has to show a further criterion by which we can judge what parts of the Bible are elastic and what rigid. If he says that the interpretation of the text is rigid, wherever it treats the doctrines necessary to salvation, we answer that for doctrines to be necessary to salvation, they must first be true. And in order to be true, according to his own principle, they must be founded on a correct interpretation of the biblical text. Thus he makes the necessity of doctrines to salvation the criterion of infallible interpretation, and infallible interpretation the criterion of doctrines being necessary to salvation. He is whirled round in a circle, having, by admitting the principle of novelty in interpretation, completely deprived himself of a basis. That he should seize the very moment in which he is most palpably betraying that he has no test of biblical truth beyond his own opinion as an appropriate occasion for flinging the rather novel reproach against popery, that its essence is to read the Bible in the light of our opinions, would be an almost pathetic self-exposure, if it were not disgusting. Imbecility, that is not even meek, ceases to be pitiable, and becomes simply odious. Parenthetic lashes of this kind against popery are very frequent with Dr. Cumming, and occur even in his more devout passages, where their introduction must surely disturb the spiritual exercises of his hearers. Indeed, Roman Catholics fare worse with him even than infidels. Infidels are the small vermin, the mice to be bagged en passant. The main object of his chase, the rats, which are to be nailed up as trophies, are the Roman Catholics. Romanism is the masterpiece of Satan. But reassure yourselves, Dr. Cumming has been created. Antichrist is enthroned in the Vatican, but he is stoutly withstood by the Boanerges of Crown Court. Personality of Satan, as might be expected, is a very prominent tenet in Dr. Cummings's discourses. Those who doubt it are, he thinks, generally specimens of the victims of Satan as a triumphant seducer. And it is through the medium of this doctrine that he habitually contemplates Roman Catholics. They are the puppets of which the devil holds the strings. It is only exceptionally that he speaks of them as fellow men, acted on by the same desires, fears, and hopes as himself. His rule is to hold them up to his hearers as foredoomed instruments of Satan and vessels of wrath. If he is obliged to admit that they are no shams, that they are thoroughly in earnest, that is because they are inspired by hell, because they are under an infranatural influence. If their missionaries are found wherever Protestant missionaries go, this zeal in propagating their faith is not in them a consistent virtue, as it is in Protestants, but a melancholy fact, affording additional evidence that they are instigated and assisted by the devil. And Dr. Cumming is inclined to think that they work miracles, because that is no more than might be expected from the known ability of Satan who inspires them. He admits, indeed, that there is a fragment of the Church of Christ in the very bosom of that awful apostasy, and that there are members of the Church of Rome in glory. But this admission is rare and episodical. It is a declaration pro forma, about as influential on the general disposition and habits as an aristocrat's profession of democracy. This leads us to mention another conspicuous characteristic of Dr. Cumming's teachings, the absence of genuine charity. It is true that he makes large profession of tolerance and liberality within a certain circle. He exhorts Christians to unity. He would have churchmen fraternize with dissenters, and exhorts these two branches of God's family to defer the settlement of their differences till the millennium. But the love thus taught is the love of the clan, which is the correlative of antagonism to the rest of mankind. It is not sympathy and helpfulness towards men as men, but towards men as Christians, and as Christians in the sense of a small minority. Dr. Cummings's religion may demand a tribute of love, but it gives a charter to hatred. It may enjoin charity, but it fosters all uncharitableness. If I believe that God tells me to love my enemies, but at the same time hates his own enemies and requires me to have one will with him, which has the larger scope, love or hatred? And we refer to those pages of Dr. Cummings's in which he opposes Roman Catholics, Puseyites, and infidels, pages which form the larger proportion of what he has published, for proof that the idea of God, which both the logic and spirit of his discourses keep present to his hearers, is that a God who hates his enemies, a God who teaches love by fierce denunciations of wrath, a God who encourages obedience to his precepts by elaborately revealing to us that his own government is in precise opposition to those precepts. We know the usual evasions on this subject. We know Dr. Cumming would say that even Roman Catholics are to be loved and succored as men, that he would even help that unclean spirit Cardinal Wiseman out of a ditch. But who, that is in the slightest degree acquainted with the action of the human mind, will believe that any genuine and large charity can grow out of an exercise of love which is always to have an arrivée pensée of hatred? Of what quality would be the conjugal love of a husband who loved his spouse as a wife, but hated her as a woman? It is reserved for the regenerate mind, according to Dr. Cummings's conception of it, to be wise, amazed, temperate, and furious, loyal and neutral in a moment. Precepts of charity uttered with faint breath at the end of a sermon are perfectly futile, when all the force of the lungs has been spent in keeping the hearer's mind fixed on the conception of his fellow men, not as fellow sinners and fellow sufferers, but as agents of hell, as automata through which Satan plays his game upon earth. Not on objects which call forth their reverence, their love, their hope of good, even in the most strayed and perverted, but on a minute identification of human things with such symbols as the scarlet whore, the beast out of the abyss, scorpions whose sting is in their tails, men who have the mark of the beast, and unclean spirits like frogs. You might as well attempt to educate a child's sense of beauty by hanging its nursery with the horrible and grotesque pictures in which the early painters represented the Last Judgment, as expect Christian graces to flourish on that prophetic interpretation which Dr. Cumming offers as the principal nutriment of his flock. Quite apart from the critical basis of that interpretation, quite apart from the degree of truth there may be in Dr. Cummings's prognostications, questions into which we do not choose to enter, his use of prophecy must be a priori condemned in the judgment of right-minded persons by its results as testified in the net moral effect of his sermons. The best minds that accept Christianity as a divinely inspired system believe that the great end of the gospel is not merely the saving but the educating of men's souls, the creating within them of holy dispositions, the subduing of egotistical pretensions, and the perpetual enhancing of the desire that the will of God, a will synonymous with goodness and truth, may be done on earth. But what relation to all this has a system of interpretation which keeps the mind of the Christian in the position of a spectator at a gladiatorial show, of which Satan is the wild beast, in the shape of the great red dragon, the two-thirds of mankind the victims, the whole provided and got up by God, for the education of the saints? The demonstration that the second advent is at hand, if true, can have no really holy, spiritual effect. The highest state of mind inculcated by the gospel is resignation to the disposal of God's providence. Whether we live unto the Lord. Whether we die unto the Lord. Not an eagerness to see a temporal manifestation which shall confound the enemies of God and give exaltation to the saints. It is to dwell in Christ by spiritual communion with his nature, not to fix the date when he shall appear in the sky. Dr. Cummings's delight in shadowing forth the downfall of the man of sin, in prognosticating the battle of Gog and Magog, and in advertising the pre-millennial advent, is simply the transportation of political passions onto a so-called religious platform. It is the anticipation of the triumph of our party, accomplished by our principal men being sent for into the clouds. Let us be understood to speak in all seriousness. If we were in search of amusement, we would not seek for it by examining Dr. Cummings's works in order to ridicule them. We are simply discharging a disagreeable duty in delivering our opinion that, judged by the highest standard even of Orthodox Christianity, they are little calculated to produce a closer walk with God, a calm and heavenly frame, but are more likely to nourish egoistic complacency and pretension, a hard and condemnatory spirit towards one's fellow men, and a busy occupation with the minutiae of events, instead of a reverent contemplation of great facts and a wise application of great principles. It would be idle to consider Dr. Cummings's theory of prophecy in any other light, as a philosophy of history or a specimen of biblical interpretation. It bears about the same relation to the extension of genuine knowledge as the astrological house in the heavens bears to the true structure and relations of the universe. One more characteristic of Dr. Cummings's writings, and we have done. This is the perverted moral judgment that everywhere reigns in them. Not that this perversion is peculiar to Dr. Cummings. It belongs to the dogmatic system which he shares with all evangelical believers. But the abstract tendencies of systems are represented in very different degrees, according to the different characters of those who embrace them, just as the same food tells differently on different constitutions, and there are certain qualities in Dr. Cummings that cause the perversion of which we speak to exhibit itself with peculiar prominence in his teaching. A single extract will enable us to explain what we mean. The thoughts are evil. If it were possible for human eye to discern and to detect the thoughts that flutter round the heart of an unregenerate man, to mark their hue and their multitude, it would be found that they are indeed evil. We speak not of the thief, and the murderer, and the adulterer, and such like, whose crimes draw down the cognizance of earthly tribunals, and whose unenviable character is to take the lead in the paths of sin, but we refer to the men who are marked out by their practice of many of the seemliest moralities of life, by the exercise of the kindliest affections, and the interchange of the sweetest reciprocities, and of these men, if unrenewed and unchanged, we pronounce that their thoughts are evil. To ascertain this, we must refer to the object around which our thoughts ought continually to circulate. The scriptures assert that this object is the glory of God, that for this we ought to think, to act, and to speak, and that in thus thinking, acting, and speaking, there is involved the purest and most endearing bliss. Now it will be found true of the most amiable men, that with all their good society and kindliness of heart, and all their strict and unbending integrity, they never or rarely think of the glory of God. The question never occurs to them. Will this redound to the glory of God? Will this make his name more known? His being more loved? His praise more sung? And just inasmuch as their every thought comes short of this lofty aim, insomuch does it come short of good, and entitle itself to the character of evil. If the glory of God is not the absorbing and the influential aim of their thoughts, then they are evil. But God's glory never enters into their minds. They are amiable, because it chances to be one of the constitutional tendencies of their individual character. Left uneffaced by the fall, and they are just and upright, because they have perhaps no occasion to be otherwise, or find it subservient to their interests to maintain such a character. Again we read, there are traits in the Christian character which the mere worldly man cannot understand. He can understand the outward morality, but he cannot understand the inner spring of it. He can understand Dorcas's liberality to the poor, but he cannot penetrate the ground of Dorcas's liberality. Some men give to the poor because they are ostentatious, or because they think the poor will ultimately avenge their neglect. But the Christian gives to the poor not only because he has sensibilities like other men, but because inasmuch as ye did it to the least of these my brethren, ye did it unto me. Dr. Cumming, it seems, is unable to conceive that the natural man can have any other motive for being just and upright than that it is useless to be otherwise, or that a character for honesty is profitable, according to his experience, between the feelings of ostentation and selfish alarm and the feeling of love to Christ. There lie no sensibilities which can lead a man to relieve want. Granting, as we should prefer to think, that it is Dr. Cummings's exposition of his sentiments which is deficient rather than his sentiments themselves, still, the fact that the deficiency lies precisely here, and that he can overlook it, not only in the haste of oral delivery, but in the examination of proof sheets, is strongly significant of his mental bias, of the faint degree in which he sympathizes with the disinterested elements of human feeling, and of the fact, which we are about to dwell upon, that those feelings are totally absent from his religious theory. Now, Dr. Cumming invariably assumes that, in fulminating against those who differ from him, he is standing on a moral elevation to which they are compelled reluctantly to look up, that his theory of motives and conduct is in its loftiness and purity a perpetual rebuke to their low and vicious desires and practice. It is time he should be told that the reverse is the fact, that there are men who do not merely cast a superficial glance at his doctrine and fail to see its beauty or justice, but who, after a close consideration of that doctrine, pronounce it to be subversive of true moral development, and therefore positively noxious. Dr. Cumming is fond of showing up the teaching of Romanism, and accusing it of undermining true morality. It is time he should be told that there is a large body both of thinkers and practical men who hold precisely the same opinion of his own teaching, with this difference that they do not regard it as the inspiration of Satan, but as the natural crop of a human mind where the soil is chiefly made up of egoistic passions and dogmatic beliefs. Dr. Cummings's theory, as we have seen, is that actions are good or evil according as they are prompted or not prompted by an exclusive reference to the glory of God. God, then, in Dr. Cummings's conception, is a being who has no pleasure in the exercise of love and truthfulness and justice, considered as affecting the well-being of his creatures. He has satisfaction in us only in so far as we exhaust our motives and dispositions of all relation to our fellow beings, and replace sympathy with men by anxiety for the glory of God. The deed of Grace Darling, when she took a boat in the storm to rescue drowning men and women, was not good if it was only compassion that nerved her arm and impelled her to brave death for the chance of saving others. It was only good if she asked herself, "Will this redound to the glory of God?" The man who endures tortures rather than betray a trust, the man who spends years in toil in order to discharge an obligation from which the law declares him free, must be animated not by the spirit of fidelity to his fellow man, but by a desire to make the name of God more known. The sweet charities of domestic life, the ready hand and the soothing word in sickness, the forbearance towards frailties, the prompt helpfulness in all efforts and sympathy in all joys, are simply evil if they result from a constitutional tendency, or from dispositions disciplined by the experience of suffering and the perception of moral loveliness. A wife is not to devote herself to her husband out of love to him, and a sense of the duties implied by a close relation. She is to be a faithful wife for the glory of God. If she feels her natural affections welling up too strongly, she is to repress them. It would not do to act from natural affection. She must think of the glory of God. A man is to guide his affairs with energy and discretion, not from an honest desire to fulfill his responsibilities as a member of society and a father, but that God's praise may be sung. Dr. Cummings's Christian pays his debts for the glory of God. Were it not for the coercion of that supreme motive, it would be evil to pay them. A man is not to be just from a feeling of justice. He is not to help his fellow men out of goodwill to his fellow men. He is not to be a tender husband and father out of affection. All his natural muscles and fibers are to be torn away and replaced by a patent steel spring anxiety for the glory of God. Happily, the constitution of human nature forbids the complete prevalence of such a theory. Fatally powerful as religious systems have been, human nature is stronger and wider than religious systems, and though dogmas may hamper, they cannot absolutely repress its growth. Build walls round the living tree as you will, the bricks and mortar have, by and by, to give way before the slow and sure operation of the sap. But next to that hatred of the enemies of God, which is the principle of persecution, there perhaps has been no perversion more obstructive of true moral development than this substitution of a reference to the glory of God for the direct promptings of the sympathetic feelings. Benevolence and justice are strong only in proportion as they are directly and inevitably called into activity by their proper objects. Pity is strong only because we are strongly impressed by suffering, and only in proportion as it is compassion that speaks through the eyes when we soothe and moves the arm when we succor. It is deed strictly benevolent. If the soothing or the succor is given because another being wishes or approves it, the deed ceases to be one of benevolence and becomes one of deference, of obedience, of self-interest or vanity. Accessory motives may aid in producing an action, but they presuppose the weakness of the direct motive, and conversely, when the direct motive is strong, the action of accessory motives will be excluded. If then, as Dr. Cumming inculcates, the glory of God is to be the absorbing and the influential aim in our thoughts and actions, this must tend to neutralize the human sympathies. The stream of feeling will be diverted from its natural current in order to feed an artificial canal. The idea of God is really moral in its influence. It really cherishes all that is best and loveliest in man. Only when God is contemplated as sympathizing with the pure elements of human feeling, as possessing infinitely all those attributes which we recognize to be moral in humanity. In this light, the idea of God and the sense of His presence intensify all noble feeling and encourage all noble effort, on the same principle that human sympathy is found a source of strength. The brave man feels braver when he knows that another stout heart is beating time with his. The devoted woman who is wearing out her years in patient effort to alleviate suffering or save vice from the last stages of degradation finds aid in the pressure of a friendly hand, which tells her there is one who understands her deeds, and in her place would do the like. The idea of a God who not only sympathizes with all we feel and endure for our fellow men, but who will pour new life into our too languid love and give firmness to our vacillating purpose, is an extension and multiplication of the efforts produced by human sympathy, and it has been intensified for the better spirits who have been under the influence of Orthodox Christianity by the contemplation of Jesus as God manifest in the flesh. But Dr. Cummings's God is the very opposite of all this. He is a God who, instead of sharing and aiding our human sympathies, is directly in collision with them, who, instead of strengthening the bond between man and man by encouraging the sense that they are both alike the objects of his love and care, thrusts himself between them and forbids them to feel for each other, except as they have relation to him. He is a God who, instead of adding his solar force to swell the tide of those impulses that tend to give humanity a common life, in which the good of one is the good of all, command us to check those impulses, lest they should prevent us from thinking of his glory. It is in vain for Dr. Cumming to say that we are to love man for God's sake. With the conception of God which his teaching presents, the love of man for God's sake involves, as his writings abundantly show, a strong principle of hatred. We can only love one being for the sake of another when there is an habitual delight in associating the idea of those two beings, that is, when the object of our indirect love is a source of joy and honor to the object of our direct love. But according to Dr. Cummings's theory, the majority of mankind, the majority of his neighbors, are in precisely the opposite relation to God. His soul has no pleasure in them. They belong more to Satan than to him. And if they contribute to his glory, it is against their will. Dr. Cumming, then, can only love some men for God's sake. The rest he must in consistency hate for God's sake. There must be many, even in the circle of Dr. Cummings's admirers, who would be revolted by the doctrine we have just exposed, if their natural good sense and healthy feeling were not early stifled by dogmatic beliefs, and their reverence misled by pious phrases. But as it is, many a rational question, many a generous instinct, is repelled as the suggestion of a supernatural enemy, or as the ebullition of human pride and corruption. This state of inward contradiction can be put an end to only by the conviction that the free and diligent exertion of the intellect, instead of being a sin, is a part of their responsibility, that right and reason are synonymous. The fundamental faith for man is faith in the result of a brave, honest, and steady use of all his faculties. Let knowledge grow from more to more, but more of reverence in us dwell, that mind and soul according well may make one music as before, but vaster. Before taking leave of Dr. Cumming, let us express a hope that we have in no case exaggerated the unfavorable character of the inferences to be drawn from his pages. His creed often obliges him to hope the worst of men, and to exert himself in proving that the worst is true. But thus far we are happier than he. We have no theory which requires us to attribute unworthy motives to Dr. Cumming, no opinions, religious or irreligious, which can make it gratification to us to detect him in delinquencies. On the contrary, the better we are able to think of him as a man, while we are obliged to disapprove him as a theologian, the stronger will be the evidence for our conviction that the tendency towards good in human nature has a force which no creed can utterly counteract, and which ensures the ultimate triumph of that tendency over all dogmatic perversions.